So the book of Shemot begins with the Jewish people in exile. You know, there was a famous statement. It's not Talmudic. People think it's Talmudic. It's not. It's relatively late. There's a famous statement that more than the Jews kept Shabbat, Shabbat kept the Jews. Yes, anyone know who said that? No. I mean, it's close. It's not. I mean, same. So I think there is a lot of truth in this, although it's probably too much of a generality. You know what? I'll say the opposite. It's too specific, and there's more general thing which has kept the Jews. So I just want to pause a second, and so now you have your homework. I want to ask a simple question, because sometimes our minds play tricks on us, and we sort of think that all exiles are essentially the same, you know. You know, they're all the same, and, you know, it doesn't make a difference if it's the Persians or the Greeks or the Romans or the Spanish Inquisition, Chmielnytsky, or the Nazis. Okay, the uniforms change, the symbols change, but it's essentially it's the same attack which is waged against us. And that's fundamentally not true, because, again, I can then say in exile, other than these incredible outbreaks that take place where we're directly attacked, there is simply surviving exile. And the survival of exile, so I can say, okay, Shabbat is what kept us. But the reason why I find that as an imprecise message is because not every challenge has always been the same. So, for example, during the Spanish Inquisition, there was a way of survival, although I have to be careful, because the way of survival was a path towards individual survival, but it wasn't a path towards national survival. And essentially, that was a choice that a person had to make at that particular time. Do I live? Do I keep my possessions? Do I become Christian? Or do I try to remain a Jew? And even in the Spanish Inquisition, the original choice was either to convert or to leave. It was only the subsequent choice, which was to make sure you stay converted or to die. I mean, that was a little bit later on. But as I said, each exile has its own particular challenges. So when I think about the exile over here in Egypt, so can I really say that what saved the Jews at that point was the keeping of Shabbat? And again, if Shabbat was too specific, so I can say, okay, it was Jewish life. It was, you want to use that word, it was halachic life. It was, you want to say it's a cultural life. But if I go back and, you know, I just think about the Jews at that time, and how can I say that at that point that the Shabbat kept the Jews when I don't know if they were Jews and I don't think there was a Shabbat? So essentially, and I know that on a midrashic level, I can speak about the various things the Jews kept, including Shabbat. But on a realistic level, I just have a harder time with that by saying that on a, I mean, what did they have? There was very, very little, but what they did have is part of what I want to get to. Yes, as I said, on a midrashic level, we assume that they kept Shabbat. But then the question is why or how or what does this mean even? So there is a tendency, listen, on a midrashic level, Avram also ate matzah. Right, and I can go on along that approach, but I'm saying, in terms of a non-midrashic approach, in terms of a more rational approach, so what exactly was the nature of Jewish existence? What exactly was the nature of Jewish identity? And I'm going to say it again: the word Jewish itself is probably not the most precise word that I can use. So who are these people, and what are these people? So that remains a question. There's actually another midrash that talks about the one thing that they should have had at that point, and that was a commandment for circumcision. And the midrash says that they stopped it. It says the Jews decided among themselves to stop circumcision. They said, let's be like the Egyptians. So of course, when you read a midrash like that, you realize there is two possibilities. One possibility is that it's reporting to us what exactly happened at that point, and the other possibility is that it's some rabbi got up in his shul and gave a speech against the people who were trying to acculturate at a later point in time. I mean, that would be a beautiful midrash during the Greek time or the Greek period. And there are other times that would have been a very relevant speech. And by the way, this point about the rabbi getting up and giving a sermon And that's what some of the Midrashim are. Don't blame me if you don't like that. The Ramban said that. The Ramban said that some of the Midrashim that we find are rabbis giving sermons. And not every sermon that a rabbi gives is there to reflect what was historical fact, but rather to express some kinds of other levels of truth. So, see, Brit Milah, circumcision, is a better argument because that's something which Avraham was actually commanded for his children. And that becomes really intriguing. So did they really keep that? Was that something which was sustained? Or is that something which they stopped? And then that's really frightening when the Midrash says, okay, let's stop. We want to fit in. We don't want to be different. So therefore, as much as, you know, what we talked a little about last week, that they can get to Egypt and they can settle in Goshen and they can move away from the general public, so it seems that didn't really work on a more long-term basis, and at some point people want to fit in. Again, it's totally unfair for me, but most of us came from America. So is it really fair for me to read the American to read the American immigrant experience going from the first generation of immigrants to the second generation to the third or to the fourth generation, and then read that back into the Egyptian experience? So of course I hope that you appreciate that it's completely unfair, but even if it's unfair, it doesn't mean that there's no truths involved in it. But again, I'm getting back to our point of having a real lack of ability of understanding. So who were these people and what were their challenges and how did they express themselves? So I want to start today by quoting something which I really like. Okay, fine. By saying something I've said before. I can quote myself, right? Yes? It's not even plagiarism. I want to start with something which I've said before and then move on. But again, there's a focus over here. And the focus is to try to figure out this identity. So when we get into the first chapter of Shemot, it tells us about a situation which quickly deteriorates. It speaks about the Jews, and here again we can point our fingers at other experiences of the Jews in exile, of their being perceived as a separate group, of their being perceived as a fifth column, they're being perceived as people who are dangerous. They're dehumanized along the way in this description, which means there's a lot of elements over here which unfortunately repeated themselves at various times in history. The first chapter leads us very, very quickly to a final solution, and I apologize for using that phrase, but there is a final solution, and the solution is interesting in as much as it was not exterminate all of them, it was only exterminate half of them. And even that was a little bit more nuanced. They didn't seem to have the resolve, the strength, the abilities, the means, the technology to kill all the male adults, but rather any male children that would be born, they would be killed. On the other hand, the woman would survive. And those of you who don't notice this, there is a certain echo over there. Again, you have to pay close attention. There's an echo to two different scenes in Bereshit. One scene was the scene before the flood, where the men, the powerful men, took whichever women they wanted. So over there, the focus was on the women, but not on the men. So what was going on there? So I'm saying that's one thing to consider. And specifically, the flood will be interesting, as we'll see in a moment. The second element or scene or narrative that we can point to would be the narrative of when Avraham and Sarah go down to Egypt. And over there, Avram feels that his life is in danger, and Sarah is going to be taken by the king. So that is really, again, as much as we perhaps don't think about it, and the Ramban is very strong about this, this is actually probably the source of the concept of Maaseh Avot, Siman Labanim, whereby things that happen in the past echo in the future, but it's actually nuanced in a couple of ways, and let's just review that to be clear about it. One is that the men are threatened, the women are taken, or in this case, there's only one. It's a microcosm, so one man is threatened and one woman is taken. But what happens? Paro and his household are struck with plagues, so here suddenly we have plagues, and then Avram leaves with a great deal of wealth. So which means basically the Brit Bein of Tarim, the covenant which God makes with Avraham subsequently, whereby he told you, your descendants will be slaved, and then I'm going to judge, and then they're going to leave with a great deal of wealth, that already played itself out in an earlier scene in Avraham's life. And therefore, again, I can't say that Avraham recognized that. I would presume that he did, because, you know, I went through this. And especially if you've experienced something, it makes it a little bit easier. I've said more than one time as well that I've always thought that the Midrashic read of Avraham's father being involved and Avraham being thrown into the furnace most likely gave Avraham a great deal of confidence when he was told that his son was going to be sacrificed. Okay, I got out of the furnace. Somehow Yitzhak is going to be saved from the altar as well. There's going to be a way out. I don't know what the way out is, but there's going to be a way out. And I know that the downside of me saying that is that on the one hand you can say it diminishes the test of the Akedah, but on the other hand, doesn't it increase the level of Avraham's faith, because he knows this is going to work out. It's going to work out. It's going to happen. Which means what we see over here is that there's a microcosm of the Egyptian experience, and the Midrash actually goes one step further. It says that the Jewish women in Egypt were saved because Sarah was saved, which means she created a spiritual footprint whereby the other women in Egypt would not be hurt by the Egyptians because of Sarah being saved. It then continues and says that because Yosef was able to withstand the clenches of Mrs. Potiphar, so therefore the men in Egypt were able to withstand that kind of attack. So the reason why this is interesting is because generally a slave society is used and manipulated and taken advantage of in every single way, especially in a sexual way. And the Midrash goes out of its way to saying that, but that was not the case in terms of the Egyptian experience. You know, the famous teaching that many of us learned that says that the Jews were saved because they never changed their clothing and they never changed their language and they never changed their names. If you actually look up the teaching, it says that, except it doesn't say clothing. Clothing isn't there. Clothing is probably an 18th century read into this, where the lavush became something so important, and therefore that became the stress of the teachings that went on from the 18th century onwards. But if you go back and you look at the actual source, it says the third thing, or the fourth, depending on which midrash you look at, was actually that they were not sexually involved with the Egyptians. Now you understand why, when we were taught this in third or fourth grade, they preferred to talk about clothing rather than the clothing being off, because that would have been a little difficult to explain. And this became a wonderful teaching. You know, till this day, wearing your Hasidic clothing is probably a good way to stop intermarriage. Right? Go to a bar, try to pick up girls wearing your bekisha. I don't know. Maybe people think, maybe think bekishas are hot. I don't know. But I've never personally tried. But let's now get back to this first chapter. Then presents us with a final solution. It presents us with the males to be killed and the women will be saved. Of course, then there's one more voice there, which is a really important voice. And it becomes a theme. And the theme is that the Jews are saved because of the righteous women. And the first righteous women we meet are the righteous women who are willing to withstand Paro in order to defy Paro and to refuse to kill the children. Paro's response is bizarre, if not preposterous, where, okay, you don't want to kill the males, that's fine, just throw them into the river instead. And to understand that, we would add that next week's Haftorah in Yecheskel tells us that Paro was a person who, within the Egyptian sensibility and mythology, was seen as the god of the Nile, the creator of the Nile. The Nile is the life force. And therefore, throwing the child into the Nile was therefore not killing him, per se. The Nile will now decide who will live and who will die. And therefore, within that mythology, it made a little bit of sense. Which leads us to chapter 2, so let's begin with chapter 2. Vayelech ish mi beit Levi vayikach et bat Levi. And a man from the household of Levi went, and he took, married, a woman from Levi. So there's something we need to stress over here. They were already married. How do I know they're already married? Because they already have two children. Unless someone's going to come and tell me that that Moshe's siblings were not siblings from his mother, only from his father, this is a different marriage, and I have no reason to say that. Rather, the Midrash fills in the information here, and it tells us that they were married, and Amram then leaves his wife. He leaves his wife because bringing a child into the world where a child will be killed is an absurdity. And why live a life of an absurdity? Which means it's better not to, you know, Tennyson's question, is it better to have loved and lost than never to have loved? So, is it better to have a young child die or better not to have that child? So it's a cruel question, and Amram decides he's not going to have children anymore. And his daughter attacks him. His daughter Miriam attacks him. And I just have to say something incidentally. Later on in the Torah, Miriam's going to become very famous in two different scenes. In one scene, she's famous because her singing and dancing and what was the musical instrument she was using? Hey, Mrs. Tambourine Man, right over there. Miriam, the original. And to dance beneath the diamond sky with one hand waving free. So apparently, I hope at least you're impressed with that. So that was that was Miriam. And the other scene where she's famous from is where she attacks Moshe. So over there, again, I'm reading in with Rashi, I'm reading in with the commentaries. She attacks Moshe for having separated from his wife. So now you realize something. Why does she think of all that she has a right to say anything over here? Because her parents separated. She was the one who told her father, buy that woman flowers and go back and make up with her and you guys get back together. When you realize that she feels that had it not been for her, Moshe never would have been in the world, and therefore she has particular sensitivity to this. Of course, if she's one of these women who were mentioned in the first chapter, which again, according to a certain Midrashic understanding as well, this is the same person. So she's the one who's involved in bringing children into the world. And over here, her parents have separated and decided bringing children is now a mistake. So therefore, you understand that she would have a heightened sensibility or sensitivity when it comes to Moshe having separated, and she believes that she has a right to say something. Of course, God disagrees. But that itself is interesting. If I can get back to that today, I will, although we're talking about 98% chance I won't. So I've said enough about that. But let's now continue. So they get back together. They remarry. Vatari Ishavatelid Ben, Vatero Tokitov, and she has a child, and she sees that he's good. You know, again, according to the Midrash, the room fills up with light. Where do they get that from, that it fills up with light? Because the first Kitov that we had in the Torah is, and God created light and saw it was good. So over here, Vatarat Kitov, so therefore they see him and he's good. It's the same, it's this theory of conservation of Kitovs. It's this light which now has entered into the room, which is the same primordial light, and so on, and I'll leave it at that. And she hides him for 3 months. So again, he was born on Zayin Adar, so he's hid for 3 months. So Moshe then gets revealed, and unhidden, he gets revealed 3 months later, which is approximately the seventh day of Sivan, which is where Chag HaShavuot. Before you attack me and say, but Chag HaShavuot is not Zayin Sivan, it is 3 months later, which means that in today's calendar, it's always connected to a date. But the original Chag HaShavuot, the Gemara says, could have been the fifth of the month, or the sixth of the month, or the seventh of the month. It just depended whether the months in between had 1 day Rosh Chodesh or 2 days Rosh Chodesh. But nonetheless, Moshe gets revealed on the seventh of Sivan. That's really significant because it means that that's really when Moshe becomes revealed, and much later on we'll find the same thing as well. She can't hide him any further. And she can't hide him any longer, so she builds an ark. So you remember we started with the flood a little while ago in terms of the powerful men and taking the women over here, and we had a little bit of an echo of the pre-flood generation, and now suddenly staring at us is we have a flood situation, but of course it's very, very different. Because in the flood, one family was going to be saved by virtue of going into the ark, and over here, one child was going to be set to certain death by being put into the ark. Of course, it's not certain death, and maybe somebody convinced her along the way, you know, okay, we're not going to throw the kid in the water, we're not going to wait for the Egyptians to come and knock on the door, so rather we're going to have some kind of the slimmest glimmer of hope that we're going to put it in the ark and maybe he'll survive, and, you know, maybe the crocodiles won't be hungry that day, maybe. I mean, this is just a total absurdity And just to imagine her experience that morning, Yocheved, it's a 3-month-old child. She has held him, she has nursed him, she has kissed him, she has sung to him, she's cried, and now she gives him away, and she knows that she's never going to see him again. And then we get to really an incredibly dramatic, it just doesn't sound that way, an incredibly dramatic verse, which we tend not to pay attention to its significance. V'teret bat paro l'rchotz al ya'or, and the daughter of Paro, of all people in the entire kingdom, the one who goes down is the daughter of Paro. She goes down to wash by the river, v'naroteo lechet al yad ha'yor, v'teret et ha'teva b'toch hasuf v'tishlach et amata v'tekacheh. So she sees that there's this ark, and it just seems quite strange. What is an ark doing here? And they take the ark. Sorry, I skipped the verse I wanted to read that I thought was great. She places him in the ark in the water, Pasuk Dalet, which I skipped. Vatetzav achoto mirachok ledea mayaselo. And his daughter and his sister is firmly entrenched, Vatetzav. She's firmly entrenched at a distance in order to know what was going to be with him. Which means while his mother could not face the reality of what was going to take place, I mean, do you really sit there and eat some popcorn and watch what happens to this? I mean, it's terrible, but his sister can't turn around. She can't walk away. And he's crying in here, and it says that very clearly afterwards. But tiftach v'teret yelvini nar bocheh, you know, there's crying going on. So I see this, of course, this is my imagination. I see this as being directly contrasted to the story of Yosef's sale. Now, the reason I want to go to Yosef's sale is, first of all, there is, I think, a great degree of significance to the sale in terms of the story. How in the world did we get to Egypt? We got to Egypt because we sold our brother and we figured we're going to sell him as a slave. And what then happens? We all become slaves. But when they sold Yosef, they threw him into the pit, and they threw him into the pit, which he could have been killed in the pit, and we understand that. And he's screaming and crying in the pit. We know this from the brothers' discussions later on. Reuven says, we heard him crying, we heard him screaming, and we just ignored this. Which means the whole going down into Egypt begins because of brothers who ignore the cry of their brother. And they turn around and walk away. And Yosef then is sent off in his caravan, and he's sent off into Egypt, but they turn around and walk away. And now we have a new book, which starts with a new scene, and this scene is so significant because over here you have a girl who can't turn around and can't walk away. But it's not just that. She goes so much further now. And in order to see really the heroism of Miriam, she goes and gets involved. Pasuk Zayin, Vatomer achoto el bat paro. Now just imagine this. This is the princess. And Miriam walks over, not invited into the conversation. She just walks over to the princess of Egypt and she says, Ha'ilech v'karati lach isha mineket min ha'ivriot? Shall I go and find for you a Hebrew to nurse this baby? V'teinik lach et hayeled, and then this person will nurse the baby for you. Do you notice that prior to this, there was no talk about the adoption? Miriam just created the narrative. Miriam just now created the path of Moshe's survival. She said, I mean, all that happened till this point is that they see a strange teva, and for all you know, when she sees a strange teva, she'll throw the baby back in the water and take the teva, because look, I can put my jewelry in this teva. I can keep this for something else. Meaning, whoever along this way said anything about taking this baby and adopting this baby? And Miriam walks over and then creates a narrative. And she says, listen, I know little babies are a little hard to deal with. You know, they're up in the middle of the night and so on and so forth. Okay, how about this? he'll already be broken in by the time we return him to you. I'm sorry for saying it like that. He'll already be finished with the nursing and all. I'll find somebody to do this, and then they'll do it for you. That wasn't on the table before Miriam did. Miriam just, I'm going to say this again, she just now created a narrative. And the narrative that she created is ultimately a narrative of salvation whereby Moshe is going to be saved. The baby crying is certainly the impetus, but that doesn't mean that she would have adopted him before, because again, there's a problem. This is a Jewish baby and she knows it. And her father had made this rule, so why should she defy him? Which means that there is something interesting here. Look, I'll point out something else, which I think we've noted before. In that first time that Avram and Sarah go down to Egypt, they're also, and this is purely on a midrashic level, that they leave Ruchush Gadol, but on the midrash they also take somebody else with her. They take Hagar, which according to the midrash is Bat Paro. And then she joins into the family. But Hagar, the daughter of Paro, never quite works out the way that one would imagine. This daughter of Paro ends up leaving with the Jews. That's a pasuk in Divrei Yomim. She leaves with the Jews, she marries into the Jewish faith, and she ends up joining our people. So at which point did this transformation take place? It's not clear. But the first statement over here of saying something, which we should not take for granted, was Miriam's statement. And then she does something else. She go, I'll go find somebody. Paro, lechi. Go. Et aim hayeled. So who does she go to of all people? She goes and she finds the mother. Paro, and then Bat Paro says to the mother of this child, I would assume not knowing it's the mother of the child, Helichi et hayeled hazeh. Go take this child, v'hiniku li, and nurse him for me, v'ni atein et tzcharech, and I will give you your wages. So a couple of hours before, Moshe's mother gave up this child, knowing that she would never see him again. And now, a few hours later, the child has been returned to her, and she will now be able to do that which she wishes to do more than anything else in the world, to hold this baby in her arms, to nurse this baby, and Paro's daughter is going to pay her to do that which she wishes to do. If at that moment they didn't believe that redemption is possible, I don't know what they were thinking. This is redemption. A microcosm, if you prefer the Kabbalistic term, bezir anpin, a microcosm. Bezir anpin means very, very small, in a very small face, very small way. This is redemption. You know, God said you're going to be abused, they're going to take advantage of you and so on, and then you're going to leave Beruchush Gadol, leave with great wealth. Paro's daughter is paying the money for her to nurse this child at this point. So I know that you're going to tell me, but it's only a temporary victory. But how can you not believe in redemption right now when you just now have witnessed redemption? The child you thought was dead will live. The thing that you want to do, you're going to be able to do. And they're paying you money to do it. I don't know how you avoid this, but I'm going to say this again. The beginning of this redemption all takes place because of one person, and that one person is Miriam. It's one girl. Again, when we say that bischut nashim tzadkaniot, that because of the righteous women, the Jews were saved, over here you see a righteous woman doing something, creating something, having so much bravery and so much intelligence and thinking on her feet and then creating this whole scenario and creating this whole narrative and basically convincing Paro's daughter that she's adopting this kid instead of throwing him back in the water, which would have been the thing that we would have predicted would have or should have happened. Because again, you're going to tell me we expected there to be compassion with a princess in antiquity? We expected her to go and to say, oh, there's a baby crying, I'll go save the baby. I mean, if I would just move over to the Nazi period, you expect the daughter of a Nazi to go and to say, oh, it's a Jewish kid, let's go save the Jewish kid. I mean, there's an atmosphere which is created over here. And the atmosphere is one which facilitated the murdering of these children. So who would have predicted that the daughter of Paro would suddenly have had this compassion? And it shows something else which happened, which is also really significant. She leaves. I mean, one of the mysteries of the entire story is that when God tells Moshe to go back to Paro and say, let my people go, if you like the movie, so he tells him to ask for 3 days. So Rabbi Soloveitchik asks, so why ask for 3 days? They're supposed to, I mean, they're leaving. They're not going for 3 days. So he said that the reality is that, you know, like you can have a director's cut and the original script of what the original script was supposed to be. The original script was that the Jews impact Paro. The Jews impact Egypt. And when Paro hears that God finally wants to have a rendezvous with the Jewish people in the desert, he's going to give them the Torah, Paro is going to say to them, please go, learn morality, learn decency, and come back and teach me, teach my people, convert all of my people, teach them all they need to know, keep them, teach them the Sheva Mitzvot, or however you want to, nuance this, and then continue your path to the land of Israel and to your destiny. Which means, on a certain level, leaving of Egypt is a prototype for the eventual Geula, the eventual redemption. The eventual redemption is not something which is just a Jewish thing. It's not just a Jewish holiday, the eventual redemption. The eventual redemption is something for the entire world. The entire world's going to be impacted. That means the entire world is going to move towards enlightenment. This is also one of the themes that's going to come up in the Haftarah next week. There needs to be enlightenment all over. So God is saying 3 days, because that's all that it should take to change over Egypt, but we fail in terms of impacting Egypt, and the opposite takes place. We sink, and the way the Zohar puts it, we fall to the 49th level of Tumah, but as I said, the way the regular Midrash puts it, we stop doing Brit Milah, we try to fit in, but we can't fit in, which of course is going to be the tragedy or the secret of Jewish survival, is that as much as we want to fit in, we can't fit in, and when we think that we fit in, maybe somebody proves to us that we didn't fit in, and at the end of the day, we survive because we don't fit in. So over here, the Jews are going to leave. The only question is, to what extent do we impact others? And that's why it's fascinating that there is one person who's impacted. And that one, again, it's other than the Erev Rav, there is somebody who's impacted. And that's somebody who we wouldn't have predicted, but that's the person who ended up saving Moshe's life. And if you want to say it's simply some quid pro quo, but I think it's more than that. I think there is some kind of transformation that takes place. But in order to understand that transformation, we now need to go to the next step. So Moshe's mother is given Moshe, and she's given a second opportunity to raise her son, who she thought she never would have the first opportunity because her husband left her. Husband comes back to her, she has this child. She has him for 3 months, but there's going to be a very big difference between the 3 months that she had and now till he is weaned. How much time takes place, I don't know. That's actually going to be one of the mysteries of this entire topic, the whole timeline. We only know one thing, and that's eventually when Moshe comes back and meets up with Paro, which is not the same Paro, he meets up with him, Moshe's 80 years old. So essentially, between the age of 3 months to 80 years, we have a real big block of time that we don't know exactly how to divide that up and how things happen. There is a midrash that says Moshe stays in Egypt till he's 40, and then his 40 years by Yitro's house. Okay, that's a very convenient. It's also thematically, it fits into other people's lives that get divided by 40, 40, and 40. So you have young Moshe in your hands now. So how long do you nurse him? Do you say after a month? Do you say after a month, okay, enough of this already? I'm, you know, please go and take this kid already. What a pain he is. He wakes me up every night. Do you nurse him for a week, for a month, for a year, for 2 years? So I would assume that the longer amount is going to be the right answer, and at some point she will return him because she won't have a choice anymore to Paro's daughter. What does she teach him during that time? What does she say to him? What is going to be the content of this? And that, to me, is a completely tantalizing question. And I'll offer a couple of answers to it. I mean, does she really teach him the Rambam Zikarim? Does she really teach him at that point, you know, the Tariag Mitzvahs? What does she teach him? It goes back to the question I started with today. So what exactly is Judaism at that point? So I guess the real answer is it's non-existent. So what exactly does it mean to be a Hebrew, an Ivri at that point? So there is a covenant, and the covenant is the Brit Bein HaBetarim. The covenant is that we are here because God sent us over here, and God will take us out. And Moshe's mother can look at him and say, you're my miracle child. You stand as proof that this will really happen. Not only that, if you're going back to the palace, you may actually have more of an active role in this than anybody ever could have imagined when the parents separated. that they thought bringing a child into the world would be absolute death. Who would have imagined that bringing this child into the world would be the key to redemption? So what does she teach him? Does she teach him that there is a Brit Beinah Batarim? Okay, it's a heavy concept for a little kid. My gut feeling is, and I'm sure I've said this before, is that she has to tell him that you're not the first Jew to be raised in the palace. You had a great uncle whose name was Yosef, and he went through all kinds of trials and tribulations, but he remained true. Of course, the great irony of this is the family of Levi, and Levi specifically, and the family of Yosef, and Yosef specifically, we never imagined would have gotten along. So therefore, again, God has a great sense of humor by now having this child from Levi being told, you know what, you got a great uncle named Yosef, and he should be your role model. So I find that amusing. On the other hand, when all the other Jews, the night before they leave, they go looking for their wealth, they go looking to borrow things, we're told that Moshe is the one who goes looks for Yosef's remains. So everyone else perhaps existed because of the hope and the dream that one day they would be paid for every single hour of work. Moshe goes, and he has a whole different thought in his mind. Maybe the thought of money is what kept them going, but the thing that kept Moshe going was the image of Yosef. And it's interesting, but the same way that Yosef was saved because the image of Yaakov, which saves Moshe, is the image of Yosef. So we have just, I think, a real interesting dynamic over there. But what else does she teach him? As I said, that's just my guess. But what else she teaches him, I think we can actually prove. And that's the following. She says to him, you're going to the palace. You will be a prince. You will be the prince of Egypt. They will name a movie after you one day. But you're not Egyptian. You're not one of them. Now this is going to be more complicated because Bithya, who's a wonderful mother, and she's a Jewish mother. How do I know she's a Jewish mother? I mean, you say she's not Jewish. She's a Jewish mother. How? Well, think of the following. We're told in Yechezkel, and I mentioned this before, that the pharaohs saw themselves as being the god of the Nile. Bithya, Pharaoh's daughter, Bithya, the daughter of a god, daughter of some powerful god. So he names his daughter Bithya. She then names him Moshe and says, Ki min hamayim mishitihu. I took him out of the water. Now that's ridiculous. What child is in the water? The child who's in the water are going to be all the Jewish kids. So everyone's going to know that he's Jewish. How could you call him this? So go back to what I said before. The first thing on the table was to kill the children. Take them and kill them. And they wouldn't do that. So I said, okay, fine. Throw them into the water instead. Because they imagined that the Nile itself was a living entity. They imagined that Paro was the god of the Nile. The Nile will decide who will live and who will die. But when you live in mythology, or a life of mythology, there's actually a downside to it. You can actually start to believe some of this stuff. So what did she then say? She takes him out of the water and says the water gave birth to him. Ki min hamayim mishitihu. Which means, why do I say that she's a Jewish mother? She thought her son was a god. She goes and sets Moshe up within the palace to be just like Paro, who's some kind of a demigod. Moshe is also a god. So now Moshe has this perfect, I won't call it an alibi. It's more than an alibi. It's an identity. Moshe's identity is that he is not just a prince of Egypt. He's one of the gods in the pantheon of the gods of Egypt. So how is this for a perfect existence? And his mother, as she's nursing him and as she's rocking him and as she's singing to him, she says to him, you're not a god, you're a Jew. You're not an Egyptian, you're a Jew. You're not part of their history and you're not part of their destiny. But if you choose, you will be a part of our history and our destiny. And that's the choice that Moshe has to make. You are one of us. You're not one of them. So now how do I know that his mother succeeded in the lessons that she gives him? So we continue and we read, and Moshe grows up twice. When I say he grows up twice, Pasuk Yud Vayigdal Hayeled, he grows up, Vativeu Levat Paro Vihila Leven, and he's given over to the daughter of Paro, and she becomes for him a son, Vatikreshmo Moshe, she calls him Moshe Vatomer, and she says, Kimen amai mishitihu, for I took him out of the water, and I'll say it again, she's declaring that the water gave birth to him, and he is in fact a god. Vayibi Memahem Vayigdal Moshe, and Moshe grows up a second time. And here is where we see what his mother did. Vayetze el Echav, and he goes out to his brothers. Now, that is not just an editorial statement. That is a description of Moshe's state of mind. Vayetze el Echav, vayar b'sivlotam. He goes out to his brothers. And how does he know that these are his brothers? Because this is what his mother taught him. He goes and he sees their suffering. Vayar ish mitzri makeh ish ivri me echav. Again, the emphasis can't be ignored. He sees an Egyptian beating a Hebrew from his brothers. So twice over here within the same verse you have brother, that Moshe has a sense of brotherhood. Now I know what his mother taught him. And again, I want to stress this point. There is no other Judaism at this point. There is nothing else. Yes, there is this Brit Bein HaBetarim. There is this historical promise. There's a covenant and there is a future. But there's nothing per se right now. You want to say they kept Shabbat? Fine, I'll agree with you just because I don't want to fight with you. You want to say they kept Simchat Torah? Fine, I'll agree with you. And they lit Hanukkah candles and they drank on Purim? I'll agree with everything you say, but you know that I'm not sincere. All that there is this sense that we are a separate people, a different people, and we have a destiny. And the destiny is that we are going to leave. V'yifan cho v'cho, and he looks one way and the other. V'yar ki ein ish, he sees no one else is there. V'yachet ha-mitzri v'tmenu b'chol. And he hits the Mitzri and he buries him in the sand. There's a Kabbalistic teaching that the word ha-mitzri, those who always hate our gematriot, so hey is 5, mem is 40. What's 40 and 5? Excellent. 45 and 90? Well, it'll make it easy because 90 tzadi and yud is 100. So 145 and resh is 345. His hamitzri is 345. And what is the gematria of the name Moshe? It's 345. So vayachet ha-mitzri, he kills the mitzri. So the mitzri that he killed was Moshe as the mitzri. Moshe is no longer the Mitzri anymore, which means this is the turning point. Who is he? What's his identity? Or if you want to put it in the person, who am I? So I was brought up, well, I've been raised in the palace. I'm an Egyptian. I'm an Egyptian prince. My mother's the princess. My grandfather's Paro. I'm a god in Egypt. As a god in Egypt, as a prince of Egypt, as somebody growing up in the royal house, he has the right to every single thing that you can possibly imagine, and thank God certain things that most of you probably can't imagine. That's what it means to be a prince in Egypt, because he's an Egyptian. But Moshe killed the Egyptian the moment that he killed the Egyptian. And he put him, b'chol, v'yatmenu b'chol. So again, the Kabbalistic teaching then says that what emerges, chol, could be sand, but chol can also be the opposite of kodesh. So this chol mitzri is gotten rid of, and this Moshe with kedusha is the one that emerges from this interaction. But there's something else that we have to pay attention to, and I hope we didn't miss. We're only the second chapter into the book of Shemot. And I've already pointed out a hint towards one of the worst behaviors in the entire book, and that is the behavior of Yosef's brothers to Yosef. But of course you all know that I constantly call the book of Bereishit the book of the siblings that can't get along, the book of the dysfunctional families, and that begins all the way back in the very first family. And in the very first family, in the very first siblings, we find our dysfunctionality, and we also find an act of killing taking place. And Cain kills Hevel for the simple reason that he does not feel a sense of brotherhood. He doesn't treat him as a brother, which means I don't know really what's worse, Cain and Hevel or Yosef and his brothers. Well, obviously, killing is worse, but they threaten to kill him, and they try to kill him, and they threw him into the pit. But the other reason why this is really unfortunate is actually two reasons. One is that the earlier example, and they know how bad this is because of what took place in the past. And we would have thought that something had changed. Growing up in Avram or Yitzchak's or Yaakov's tent, we would have thought that something was changed. That these guys went to yeshiva, right? It's a little funny, but they went to Beis Yaakov, right? They should have known better. There is something over here that we have to be profoundly disappointed when we look at the way that Yosef's brothers treat him. But over here, again, only the second chapter over here, and we realize that that scene of the brothers turning around and ignoring the cries, and here we have a girl who can't turn around and she can't ignore the cries. And the fact that somebody is going to kill their brother because there's no sense of brotherhood, over here you have almost a mirror image of this, of somebody who kills, and don't tell me that all taking of life is the same, but somebody kind kills Hevel because of lack of sense of brotherhood and because of jealousy and because of rage, and ultimately because he did not believe his brother had any value. Over here, Moshe sacrifices everything in his life. He sacrifices being the Egyptian prince. He sacrifices everything in his life because of a sense of brotherhood, because he feels that this person is brother, and his brother is being attacked, and his brother needs to be defended, and he needs to get involved. Which means that in reality, what we have right here is a total inverse of the Cain and Hevel story, and we're only up to the second chapter of Shemot. I mean, the thing that I would add then is that there is reason to have incredible hope at this point. There is reason right now. First of all, the reason to have hope is because all of those mistakes from that book of Bereshit, we seem to confront them and create a new reality. Siblings care about one another in this book. And it's the reason why it's really interesting is because the book of Bereshit really was a book of families. We're no longer a family now. Now we're the Jewish people. The difference between the behavior of Moshe's sister versus Moshe is that Moshe's sister, she feels responsibility for her kid brother. Now, let's not take that for granted. It seems to be absent for most of Bereshit. Maybe Yehuda is forced at some point to get to that understanding, but she, in such a natural way, without, you know, a great deal of guilt and without a great deal of drama in the background, in a negative sense, she just understands this. She intuits this. This is what she needs to do. So therefore, again, this incredible greatness of Miriam. But by the time we got to Moshe over here, Moshe has come to a whole new level with this. Because Moshe is not doing this simply to protect his kid brother. Moshe is doing this to defend another Jew. But what's so significant about this is that Moshe doesn't see another Jew just as another Jew. He sees another Jew as his brother, which means we have a total reversal from the book of Bereshit. And I'll say it again, we're only into the second chapter of Shemot, which means how does that book end? That book ends with basically everybody dying. This book is going to end with light, just like we had light here in the very beginning. The very beginning of the book, we have Moshe is born in Kitov, and the light comes in, and the light fills up the entire household. Again, that's the Midrash, Kitov. How does the book end? The book ends with the Shekhinah coming down and filling up the Mishkan. This is going to be a book of light. They're going to walk out of Egypt. They're going to have a rendezvous with God at Mount Sinai. They're going to accept the Torah, and the world is going to change. But the very basis of this is really going to be the behavior of one girl. One girl who then could inspire. And again, according to the Midrash, she pushes her parents. She inspires her parents. According to the text, she inspires the daughter of Paro to do the right thing. That's not a simple thing. Because essentially it's breaking the law. It's breaking the law of genocide. And say, no, you're going to rebel against this law of genocide. I'm going to make it easy for you. I'm going to solve all the technical problems over here, and you're going to bring this kid home. And when you realize the absurdity of what she actually had said, it's incredible. But she creates the narrative. She creates this. She creates salvation. But she creates something else. She creates within this family there to be simply a different type of value system. The value system is one that you don't turn your back on your brother. The value system is, it doesn't make a difference the personal danger that you're putting yourself into, you don't turn your back on your brother. And that she, as a little girl, can walk over to the princess of Egypt and she can say, listen, lady, how do you walk over to her? How do you say, listen, I'll help you out. I'll find someone to nurse this kid for you. How do you do such a thing? That's absurd. But she does that nonetheless. Moshe somehow, and it's not a mystery, he inherits the same value system. So apparently this is what his mother taught her. And maybe this is really where Miriam gets it from her parents and so on. But there's something over here in this family which is different. Later on, when Aaron somehow is going to come and looking for Moshe, he's going to come with the gladness of his heart. He's going to come with a smile, with happiness, which means two brothers uniting and they're happy to see one another. So how often was that taking place in Bereshit? Even when brothers got together, we were always suspicious of it. He was trying to bite his neck and he's trying to kill him. And they're both planning, you know, the others, you know, the only thing that saves them is they want to avoid mutual destruction. And over here, you have two brothers, Moshe and Aaron. And again, there's a slight part of this where the older brother is rejected and the younger brother is going to be the savior. And Aaron, for his part, is completely, completely happy with Moshe's role as the leader. And Moshe is completely happy with Aaron's role that he has. And what we have is, again, in this real natural sense, these people working together, living together, respect. And then you realize how a new nation can come out of this. Because ultimately, the secret of nationhood is to treat other people who are not your biological family, to treat them as if they are family. That's the secret of the Egyptian experience, is that when we were downtrodden and we were taken advantage of and we were abused in every type of way, then the Torah constantly comes back and says to us, don't treat the stranger like this. Don't treat this person like this. You were slaves in Egypt. You know what this was like to be the disenfranchised. You know what it was like to be the one who suffered. The message that you need to take away from this is that you can't treat others like this. But rather what Judaism is saying is you need to treat other people as if they're family. I remember years and years ago, I was once teaching. I have no idea what I was talking about. I probably did at the time, but I have no recollection of what the topic was. And it was an audience of mostly quote-unquote secular Jews. And I was watching, you know, the audience, you know, how they're responding. And I noticed something takes place towards the back of the room. I noticed this happens. There's a guy sitting next to a girl, and they'd come together to this lecture. And I see that she elbows him, and he leans over and listens. And he says, yes, and he raises his hand. So I'm waiting for this, what he's going to say. And he says, you just made a value judgment. And apparently, you know, I've been out of America for a long time, and I didn't know you're not supposed to make value judgments. So I asked him, so what's the problem with making a value judgment? Which, by the way, got him. And now it turned out that he was actually a lawyer, and the girl with him, well, she claimed she was an actress. Turns out she was a waitress. Apparently there's some kind of correlation between those. And he starts with, well, you're not supposed to make value judgments. So I said, okay. So let me ask you a question. Let's say that there is an elderly woman and she's standing by the street corner and she has lots of packages. Should you help her cross the road? So he had a hard time with that question, which actually accomplished the first goal. So he said like this, help her cross the road. So he says, yeah, you should help her cross the road. I said, well, what if she didn't want to cross? You just made a value judgment. So, okay, so let's try again. Let's say that there's a woman with a bunch of packages by the side of the road, and she wants to cross the road. And she asks you to help her cross the road. Do you help her cross the road? So he said, yeah. I said, what if on the other side of the street are a murderous band of people who like to kill old ladies? Do you help them cross the street? Help her cross the street. So now he was stuck because he has to make a value judgment and this was the objective. And he said, well, she wants to cross. He goes, well, I won't help her cross. I said, well, you stop her. He said, no, but I would inform her of the relative liabilities involved. And he turned into a lawyer. It was like the most evil thing I'd ever witnessed in my life. I saw right in front of me somebody like turn into a lawyer, and he and by the way, the girl that he was with, she sort of like moved away from him at that point. I think I broke them up. Anyway, so he said I would inform her of the relative liabilities involved in crossing the road and so on. So I said, you know, Judaism is in favor of making value judgments. But it's interesting. I said, what would you do if that woman was your grandmother? Would you inform her of the liabilities, or would you stop her? So he lost then. He didn't even ask, is there a will or anything? So he said, I said, would you put both arms around her and stop her, or inform her of the relative liabilities involved in her crossing the road? He goes, I would stop her. I said, basically, Jewish values is we treat every single person as if they're our grandmother. And in order to do that, we need to make value judgments. And it's not enough to see other people just as people. Moshe over here sees these people as if they're his brothers. He sees brotherhood, he senses brotherhood, he feels brotherhood, which means this is a whole new book. Now, what happens next, and this is really remarkable, because I think this is like an all-time least amount of sources that we've gotten through in a shiur, but I hope you're not going to be too upset with me. And this was, I hope that this was okay for what we did today. But what happens next is just going to go back to our time frame problem. We know that Moshe is going to come back when he's 80 years old. We don't know how long he's been away. We don't know what's going on through Moshe's mind at this particular point. We don't know how much hope he has in the Jewish people and how much he senses that they're ready for this or not. What I will say is at this particular point, the Torah has revealed to us that all the seeds have been planted, and this will be a book of redemption. And redemption doesn't start with the splitting of the sea. And the redemption doesn't start with the 10 plagues. Redemption begins when one little girl feels a sense of brotherhood and can't turn her back on her brother. That's the beginning of redemption. Redemption continues when a man who's willing to sacrifice everything in his career because there's a downtrodden, distant relative of his who needs his hand, who needs his help, and needs justice. That's the beginning of redemption. So as much as in the Sefer Bereishit, siblings don't get along, who would have guessed that this vicious cycle would have been broken by a little girl named Miriam who saves her brother and then by extension saves the entire Jewish people?